1899, there was an American geologist named Thomas Crowder Chamberlain, whose scientific focus was in glaciology, the study of glaciers. While trying to understand how the Earth's climate was affecting his changing landscape, he discovered that the Earth was in fact warming, and published what was one of the first studies on climate change, crediting growing levels of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. That was 120 years ago. Today, we're going to unpack Parshat Noach, or the story better known as Noah and the Ark. And in biblical stories, for reasons that we won't try to understand today, characters lived for hundreds of years, and the amount of time between when God told Noah to build the ark and the rain began to fall was 120 years. So, by my biblical application calculations, it's ark time. To help connect these ideas and try to make sense of a quiet man, an angry God, and a flood that decimated the Earth's inhabitants, I've asked my sibling Ortal Oman to join Rabbi Adam and I. Besides being one of my favorite people, Ortal works on the climate and energy team at the Union of Concerned Scientists, one of the oldest science advocacy organizations in the country, comprised of over 250 analysts, policy and communication experts, and scientists, dedicated to solving our planet's most pressing problems, where they are currently working to get fossil fuel companies out of the way in order to pass good climate and energy policy. Before working at Union of Concerned Scientists, Ortal helped train the next generation of global health organizers with Partners in Health in Boston, and often says that every policy is a public health policy. When I think of the story of Noah and the Ark, I think of a kid's fairy tale with a big boat and a bunch of cute animals. But the text is a lot darker and scarier. I mean, the entirety of life on planet Earth was destroyed because God was angry at humans. And the one guy God warned stays mum, doesn't tell a soul, and leaves his neighbors to drown. Today we'll discuss what we can learn from Noah's silence, who in this story we're supposed to relate to, and why now, when it feels that the rains have started to fall, we should still have faith. Not even in God, but in ourselves. I'm glad you're here, and know that your listening and participating in this weekly practice has been inspiring and motivating for us. Help us get the word out by leaving a review and a rating on iTunes or the Apple Podcast app on your phone if you've got it, because the more people that join us, the more we have to draw from. Okay, on to the show. It's a family affair here at the study, and I'm excited to welcome my sibling Ortal to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Rabbi Adam, as always, an honor to study with you.
We are not siblings technically, but I do consider you a brother from another mother, so can I be included in this little family affair?
Absolutely. You know, only, what, two episodes in now, and we can call each other Mishpacha officially. I'm very into it.
Good, good. Things move quickly here in the study.
That's right. So this week we're in the Parsha of Noach, or Noah, and I feel like we all remember the story from when we were little of the guy and his zoo of a boat. Could you, Rabbi Adam, give us the rabbinical recap? Because when I went back and I read this Parsha, it was far more horrifying than I remembered it.
It is a totally horrifying Parsha. My mother-in-law is really into decorating with Noah's Ark art and trinkets and things like that, and really wanted to decorate the baby's room in all Noah's Ark stuff. And I said, this is a story of the death of literally everyone on Earth except for one boatload of people. I'm not using that as the decoration for our child's room. Yeah, it's a kind of horrifying story. So it starts with God looking down at the world and feeling an emotion that we don't usually associate with deities, feeling regret, feeling like creation has gone in a different direction than God intended, and like a small child who is unhappy with a structure of blocks, it's time for God to kick the whole thing down. And God says, I'm going to wipe the slate clean and start over. But rather than starting entirely from scratch with creation, I'll instead preserve one pair of everything that I've created. One pair of each animal and one pair of humans together with their kids. And we'll use that as the building block to start again. And then we've got the story that most of us have learned in one way or another about Noah and his big boat together with the animals making their way while it rains 40 days and 40 nights and wipes the earth clean. Noah then gets out of the boat after the flood, takes a look around at the destruction, and immediately plants a vineyard, makes himself some wine, and gets completely drunk. Which I would think actually, yeah, is an interesting clue into the lived experience of what the flood would have been, right? That we, when we retell this story, tell it as a fable with the animals coming twosie-twosies. But if you actually lived through the drowning of the world, by the time you'd witnessed all of that, I would think that all you would want would be to make yourself unconscious. Because it's a really horrifying story. And I'm hoping that in the course of this conversation, we can spend a little bit of time wrestling with it and reckoning with it to try to figure out what, if anything, we can learn from God's temper tantrum, essentially wiping out all of creation and starting anew.
It feels like part of Torah study and part of all empathic living, for that matter, is putting ourselves in the shoes of others to better understand them and ourselves. So if we're to regard this story as a useful analogy for our own relationships and responsibilities to each other and the planet's health, among other things, I'm wondering, where do we fit in here? Who from this story should we see ourselves in? Is it Noah? Is it those who aren't heeding God's warnings? Is it the animals? Sometimes I feel like there's a very clear telling of who we are supposed to see ourselves as in Torah. And this one, I'm at a little bit of a loss.
Yeah, one of the interesting things with Noah and then with the next major hero that the Torah is going to introduce next week, Abraham, is that these major characters don't get a backstory. Like, you would expect to know why Noah is the one human being on earth who deserves to be saved, or why Abraham is the one human being on earth to get the message of monotheism. But instead, the Torah just jumps in with a character. So we are introduced to Noah with the words, Noah was a righteous man in his generation, no more explanation, and then God starts with the instructions on boat building. And that leaves a really big question of who is this guy, and how are we supposed to identify with or even understand somebody who we have no psychological portrait of? And maybe there's an element in which Noah then is supposed to be an everyman. Anybody who is righteous could see themselves in, or who sees themselves as righteous could see themselves as Noah. But I'm not sure. I wish that the Torah gave more details on this character so we could have some sense of how it is we're supposed to relate to him.
Yeah, it almost feels like Noah is anything but the everyman, because he's treated totally different than every other man.
Right. Yes.
Noah's largely silent, it feels like, until after the flood. We don't know a lot about him, and we also don't really know anything about what he says. He speaks mostly through his actions, like building the actual ark. And I know there's a lack of exposition, but I'm wondering, why wasn't Noah more vocal about what was to come? And are we to learn from that, the outcome of this story, that actions alone aren't sufficient? Because everyone died, do we see any relationship to the ethics of Noah's lack of verbal communication with others to Judaism's absence of proselytizing? Is there anything to be taken not only from lack of exposition, but lack of his actual speaking?
Well, Noah doesn't say anything. It's not just he doesn't say a lot. He doesn't say anything until the whole flood incident is over. God says, and Noah does. And the rabbis in the Talmud are going to kind of dogpile on Noah for that. They are going to say that Noah is much less than Abraham or much less than Moses, both of whom hear about God intending violence, Abraham hearing about God intending to destroy the city of Sodom, Moses hearing God a few times saying, I think I'm done with this Jewish people, let me wipe them out and start again. And in both cases, Abraham and Moses intercede with God and argue with God and insist that God behave in a just way. And Noah just goes along with it. Noah is this model of silent obedience that we might think is what is expected of a religious person. But the Jewish tradition is going to say Noah in some ways failed a test when you're told that your sisters and brothers and siblings are all going to be carried away by a flood. You're supposed to say back, no, God. You may not be successful, but you're supposed to at least try. And here Noah is just sort of silently following orders.
I want to bring Ortal into the conversation and start with something that we've discussed a little bit about in the past. And it feels like a really important way to think about how and who is affected here. Because Noah adapted to a changing environment, but Noah's adaptation was arguably a product of his privilege. He had direct access to God, who warned and advised him, whereas everyone around him ultimately died. And one could argue that some subsets of humanity are currently adapting and might very well end up weathering our own climate catastrophe. But I think it's safe to assume that if we continue on, you know, our current trajectory, the majority of our species won't survive. So if we're to consider Noah's story as a useful parable for our own times, I want to ask you, Ortal, the same question that I asked Rabbi Adam. Who among us is whom, and how does that relate to the work that you've done? Is there a comparable privileging of information here and access to power today that we see in Noah's story?
Yeah, I really appreciate this question of like, who are we in this story? And you're questioning Adam, Rabbi Adam, about like, you know, it's really not clear. I think that we're a little bit everyone in this. Like, I see humanity in God here. I think we're a little bit Hashem in the story, because we actually have the information that we need. We know when the flood is coming. We know that flooding is becoming more frequent and more extreme. We're a little bit Noah because we actually do as a, you know, as a whole species, not all of us individually, not all of our communities, but as a species, we have the resources that we need to get out alive if we really want to put in the work to build the ark together. And we're also a little bit everybody else because we're all at risk here. Climate change is not only going to affect one subset of people or some of us. It's coming for all of us. Just some of us have the resources to deal with this and some do not. So I think, when I see how climate change has been responded to so far and sort of you're talking about a privilege of information, what I think about is how long we've known about this problem and how little we're doing about it. And the truth is that the general public has known about climate change for a really long time, but the truth has also been hidden from us for a really long time. And fossil fuel companies have known about climate change since long before the public knew. Since the late 50s was kind of the first time that this issue really started coming up in the fossil fuel space and conversation. And by the mid 60s, the American Petroleum Institute, which is this like major lobby, like third party lobby industry group for the fossil fuel industry, acknowledged that the world was, as they said, quote, running out of time to address climate change. That was in the mid 60s.
Wow.
by the late 70s, Exxon's own scientists were sounding the alarm within the company about the need to change energy strategies. And through all of that time, this is sort of, I'm looking at this as like God's warning, not to say that fossil fuel companies are God, I think just the opposite, although they like to play God, right? And they kept information from the public in order to, you know, in order to profit and make sure that we were hooked on this, on fossil fuels, on their product. And so that really makes me angry. And I think the same way that I am really angry at God and at Noah when I read this story of like, why didn't you warn anyone? Yeah, Noah, why didn't you fight back? Hashem, like, how could you just say, okay, we're done. Like, I'm just gonna call it a day. This didn't work. Let's get rid of everything. That's not an appropriate response to things going wrong. You can't just ignore it and try to start again. So that doesn't really answer your question necessarily of who we are in this story, but just to say, like, I think there is a little bit of a privilege of information here in how much time some people in power have known that the flood is coming, and how much that information has been kept from the general public who really needs it in order to figure out a safety plan. And to address the, you know, the coming catastrophe, the ongoing catastrophe, really at this point. But the good news about climate change and climate science is that we actually do know the truth now. Climate science, like the truth is out there, but it's definitely harder to access than it needs to be. And it doesn't help now, right, that we have an administration that is sort of doing the fossil fuel industry's work for them. And making it even harder to access accurate information, making it more confusing for people to understand how to address climate change.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate the idea that we can look at a Parsha or a story and see ourselves in everyone, and the opportunities to learn from these stories seems to grow exponentially if you actually practice reading the Torah that way. Which is something I don't think I've ever done. Even watching a movie or reading a book, I feel like I search for the character that I'm going to kind of hold on to and go on that journey. But that the Torah might be offering us many different perspectives here, and that we should see ourselves in each one. That's really exciting.
I think too, like, I mean, Noah, I think there's maybe like a desire to see ourselves in Noah because it's nice to see ourselves as a protagonist. But in reality, I think maybe we are mostly the fellow citizens who don't get the warning. And when I think about like who has to act, it's really the all of us.
Right.
We're not going to get out, or at least it's irresponsible to just build an ark and be like, peace out. I'm safe.
Yeah, I think I'm only comfortable with trying to come up with an identification with Noah if we're identifying with Noah as a problematic character. To say, you know, what are the ways in which Noah fails to get word out that he has particular access to and that might help to protect other people? How does Noah fail to speak truth to power when it comes to God? And how do we fail to warn one another, to look out for one another? And how do we fail to speak truth to power? There's this amazing commentary on Noah's character by a Hasidic Rebbe, Reb Levi Yitzhak of Berdichev, who lived in the 19th century. And Reb Levi Yitzhak was famous for being the defense attorney of the Jewish people. Many of his prayers and writings are directed at God as pleas for God to step up and fulfill God's end of the bargain, up to and including one famous Kol Nidre night, the night leading into Yom Kippur, where Reb Levi Yitzhak convenes a Beit Din, convenes a rabbinic court to try God for the pogroms, for the anti-Jewish massacres that had happened in the previous year. And when Reb Levi Yitzhak is talking about Noah, he says that what Noah's story teaches us is it teaches us the danger of being small in one's own eyes, seeing oneself as small and insignificant and unable to make meaningful change, that Noah ought to have known that he had capacity to act, that he had a voice that needed to be heard. And Noah's failure to believe in the power of his own voice ultimately leads to the destruction of the world. And that sin, really, that sin of not believing in our own power, and therefore just letting things continue on in their course because we don't think that we can make any individual impact, is something that I think we need to all be incredibly careful of. We are 2 weeks from an election, give or take. And even in this incredibly fraught moment, there will still be millions and millions and millions of eligible Americans who will, not because their vote is being suppressed, though that will happen to many, but will simply not speak because they have internalized the message at some level that their voice is meaningless in making change. And that may make all the difference. It certainly has in the past. So the identification with Noah, I don't think ought to be the identification with a hero, but rather the identification with a really flawed character, as the later Jewish tradition sees him, and is pointing us to an essential potential flaw in ourselves.
The bringing up of Yom Kippur also reminds me of when I read this Parsha back and was talking it through, I really started thinking about the Unetana Tokef prayer on Yom Kippur and these questions that we ask that seem to be up to God as we're being written into the Book of Life or Book of Death. And we ask, who will die by fire and who will die by water and who will die by hunger and who will die by thirst? And these aren't actually questions that are about God anymore, especially thinking of climate change. When we're asking who will die by fire, we decide that now. Fires in California and along the West Coast and in Colorado, we decide who has the resources to get out of there. When we just say who will die by water, we're deciding that to take no action as hurricanes are becoming more frequent and more extreme, and to not provide help to those who need it. Who by hunger, that's also a climate change issue, right? Like looking at drought and how the changing climate is affecting agriculture, and who by thirst. So these questions really are, I think, so similar to that idea of Noah giving up his power by simply believing that he doesn't have any. It's also, it's simultaneously, it's giving up responsibility. It's saying, well, I don't have any power. I don't have any responsibility. But if we're able to say, actually, yeah, we are all making these decisions every day. We have the power to hold off this flood in a way. But we have to see ourselves as responsible. We have to understand that these are not acts of God anymore. These are not natural disasters. These are man-made disasters.
You started off review by saying that this is a family affair, and I have two of the three Ullman siblings here. You are both people who believe that you have a voice and put it to good use. And I'm just wondering if the two of you could reflect at all on like where you think that came from. Does that come from your family, from your lineage, from ways that you were raised?
Or Todd, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, my like immediate thought there is that we were raised in a house with a mother who was very involved in her union. Our mother is a retired grade school teacher. And I think that idea of we all take care of each other, we have a voice and we use it and we bargain for what we need. And we, you know, we don't just sit down when something is going wrong. I credit that a lot to her involvement in the union and sort of knowing what that was from a very young age. And I think, I mean, just the Jewish tradition of asking questions and believing that your voice and your opinion matters, and the idea that your questions can change the tradition in a way instead of just being shut down. I think that that was a really powerful way to grow up as well. That's a really, not everyone gets that in Jewish education, certainly. But I think it is inherent in some ways that at least our family approached Judaism of like questions are welcome, questions are important, and our voices are all part of our building our tradition.
I'm wondering if we're to see ourselves as the people, perhaps as some animals, as a flawed Noah, what are our responsibilities as people whose power pales to that of those who write and implement policy? Like you were saying, Tal, who run major corporations, how do we avoid falling into the trap of doing nothing because we ourselves might not have as much power as others? And I know we've discussed using our voices is a big one, but you work for an organization that goes a step beyond that. And I'm wondering how to help feel empowered in this moment.
Yeah. And that's a tough one some days, I'm not going to lie, because the picture is bleak and the longer we take to act, the more we're going to lose. But I think for me, what I really try to remember and meditate on is, yes, it is true that we're going to lose a lot. We're going to lose a lot of natural beauty. We're going to lose homes. A lot of people are going to die. And every day that we fail to take appropriate action, we're going to lose more and more. But there's still so much that we can save. There's still so much that has not been baked in to the outcomes yet. There's still so much left to salvage, so much life and beauty left to salvage. And we have the solutions. We actually know what we need to do. It doesn't mean that it's going to be easy, and it doesn't mean that the entire pathway is laid out for us, but we actually know the problem and we've known it for a long time and we know how to solve it. And sometimes it feels like we don't because everyone keeps telling us no. And if I can credit the past few months of pandemic chaos for anything, I think that it has, living in this world of uncertainty, has helped kind of blow the lid off of the idea that anything is impossible. And things that we were told no, no, no over and over again, all of a sudden became like, well, yeah, I guess we have to now. And I think we've been at that point of like, ooh, we really got to do something about climate change for a long time. And we keep being told no. But I think we have seen and are seeing that if we don't shut up about it, if we really fight and we just keep hammering home the solutions that we have, the need to transition away from fossil fuels, the need to look out for each other and not leave, you know, still developing countries behind, not leave poor communities and communities of color, indigenous communities in the U.S. behind. We know how to get out of this. It just takes all of us not giving up. And we sort of need to hold each other accountable to that. But I think it's an Alice Walker quote. She said that the most common way that people give up their power is by believing they don't have any. And I think it's a real mistake to think, oh, well, you know, decisions are made by the government or decisions are made by corporations. In many ways, that is true. And I would never try to convince people that our individual actions, like recycling, are going to be what fixes things, because it's just not true. We need much bigger actions than that. But when we all stand up, that's a little bit, I'm trying to move away from that as like an ableist term. But when we all get loud and we don't back down, we do have control over corporations. We do have control over the government. And one of the places that I find a lot of hope and power in is in the youth movement these days. I mean, the youth climate movement, I think, is where so much of the excitement and energy is. And that type of work, young people who are really, really in it because they know the stakes and their future is at stake, that's what gives me energy these days, looking at the people who are really already taking big, big action and who have won a lot.
And what does that, just to be clear, what does that mean to win right now?
Yeah, It's a great question. I think that when you look at local work, you can find wins that are maybe a little more satisfying than you can see at the congressional level at this point. But, you know, people are winning local pipeline fights, and people are winning fracking permit fights. And we're already seeing, I mean, in the, you know, in the fossil fuel industry space, we're seeing the financial sector really start to back away from fossil fuels because of grassroots pressure, because they see that this is not a good long-term investment. No one wants this anymore. You have to celebrate the small wins to be able to feel it. But I think when you do look at what's happening, like in the ground game, we're seeing wins all over. It's just that they're not quite big enough yet to save us all, so to speak.
So the lesson really is, don't be Noah. Use your voice and get loud. Because I guess sometimes I think that talking to my friends or sending out a tweet, I'm working on a documentary about a pipeline fight, that none of that would actually be enough. But you're saying that just if we all get loud enough, we actually have the power to change things on the local level, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think just on the local level. I think that that is true, and sometimes we can see wins faster on the local level because we can exert more power over our local leaders. But it doesn't have to be that small. It just takes all of us rising up together. And I also don't, you know, I don't want to imply that sending a tweet or talking to your friends is the end of it, right? Because it's not. I think we have to get a little bit louder than that and get out of sometimes like the comfort of just texting people who will already agree with us, and we have to be strategic about things. Just talking to each other about climate change isn't necessarily going to change anything. We really have to be pressuring our leaders, who currently do have the power to pass important legislation, or to move us away from fossil fuels, or to put more money into renewables, or to put more money into mitigation and adaptation to help people who are on the front lines of climate change, who are seeing damages first and worst. You know, we have some amount of power over that as well. I think sometimes it's easy to forget that our elected officials work for us, but we hired them, you know, and we pay their salaries, and we can kick them out if they're not taking care of us, because that's their job.
Yeah.
So I guess in this story, I wish Noah had kind of kicked God out, but that's not really so much an option.
Yeah, fair enough. Rob Adam, I feel like we've strayed straight into only climate action and perhaps away from Torah. Is there anything else Parsha-wise that I'm missing here?
I mean, I think this is all Torah, and that's certainly what this study is all about, is the way in which Torah bleeds into life and life bleeds into Torah. And Ortel, I think the points that you're making are so incredibly important and incredibly timely, and beautifully stated. I guess just to come back around to that, was Noah a good guy question. I said that the rabbis in the tradition pile on to Noah and compare him negatively to Abraham and Moses. There's a specific discussion about the very first line of Noah's story, that where Noah is described as Ish tzaddik tamim bedoratav, a good and righteous person in his generation. And there's a debate on that in the Talmud. Why does it need to say in his generation? It could just say Noah was a good and righteous man. And one side of that debate says he's a good and righteous man in his generation, but he lived in a really crappy generation. And so being a D plus student in a world of Fs makes you good. If you're grading on a curve, but it doesn't actually imply that you're the level of morally upstanding that we're going to need to save the world. The other side of it, though, says in his generation is actually added to be a compliment to Noah, because how much harder is it to be a voice for what's right when everybody around you is going in the opposite direction? When we're all within our own echo chamber, there's not actually a lot of points, I think, Ortel, as you were saying, for saying something that everybody already agrees with. The risky action and the needed action is to get outside of our small circle of friends and to speak a bigger truth in a time in which science is under fire, in which facts are under fire, in which the concept of truth itself is under fire. That's harder now, maybe, than it's ever been before. We've been mostly following the rabbinic lead and piling on Noah and wishing that Noah had stepped up, but maybe to leave us with a sense that, you know, Noah had a really hard job to do. He didn't do it fully, but to speak out in a world that's gone completely mad is a really hard thing. And we find ourselves in a world that feels oftentimes like it's really gone mad. And we should give ourselves the credit that it's a really hard thing. It doesn't get us off the hook that it's hard. It's all the more important, even though it's hard. But to recognize that it's that what you're talking about, Artal, is so necessary and quite daunting.
Well, I really appreciate you guys helping take apart such a daunting parsha and helping point us in the right direction. Artal, is there anything that we want to hit before we're out of here?
Go vote. Ask your friends what their voting plan is. Make sure that everyone you know has a plan to either mail in their ballot or get to their polls early or get to the polls on November 3rd. And, you know, climate change may not be the top item on everyone's list, but it's a big one, and it goes all the way down the ballot. And so I think keeping in mind, you know, floods are coming. We're in one in many ways, and we have the opportunity right now to sort of let billionaires build their arcs and leave us behind, or we have the opportunity to build something together. And that's going to take a lot of different things. And one of the things that it's going to take is all of us speaking with one voice on this on November 3rd or before, preferably. I dropped off on my ballot yesterday.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks.
I did mine today. Thanks. It felt really good.
Oh, yeah. Now we're talking. Well, guys, thank you so much. And Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
A long time ago when the earth was green, there were more kinds of animals than you've ever seen. They ran around free while the earth was being...
When we were little kids, our father used to play a lot of guitar and banjo, which at 5 years old was an incredible party trick. He'd play at Hebrew school functions or at synagogue for certain holidays. When I realized we were making this a family episode, I suddenly had this memory of my Abba singing a song about Noah, the Ark, and some lonely unicorns. So I asked him if he'd tune up the old guitar and send me a recording, which is what we're listening to right now.
He said, "Hey, brother Noah, I'll tell you what to do. Go and build me a floating zoo. And take two alligators and long-necked geese, humpty-back camels and chimpanzees, take cats and rats."
The study is produced by Evan Scott Nicholas and me, Raviv Ullman. My co-host is Rabbi Adam Greenwald. Our guest today was Artal Ullman. Artwork by Julia Pott. Music by my father, Brian Ullman, and Blue Dot Sessions. See you next week.
He called out as day went through, "Hey Lord, I got your green alligators, your long-necked geese, humpty-back camels and some chimpanzees, some cats and rats and elephants, but Lord, I'm so forlorn, I just can't see no unicorn." Then Noah looked out through the pouring rain. Them unicorn were out playing silly games. They were kicking and splashing in the misty morn. Oh, them silly unicorn. But there were green alligators and long-necked geese, humpty-back camels and some chimpanzees. Noah cried, "Close the doors, 'cause the rain is pouring. I just can't wait for no unicorn." The ark started moving and it drifted with the tide. The unicorn looked up from their rock and cried. The water came up and kind of floated them away. And that's why you'll never see a unicorn to this very day. But you'll see green alligators and long-necked geese, humpty-back camels and some chimpanzees, some cats and rats and elephants, but sure as you're born, you're never gonna see no unicorn. But you'll see green alligators and long-necked geese, humpty-back camels and some chimpanzees, some cats and rats and elephants, but sure as you're born, the loveliest of all were the unicorns.